do you do when the iceberg is looming and the ship isn't turning away? How can you be heard when the warning bell's booming but the band just continues to play? Where do you turn when the engines catch fire and the life rafts are starting to burn? What do you do when the lifeboats are burning? Turn, 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 turn to each other, reach for each other, take one another by the hand. We'll form a life raft, a human life raft, and we'll swim toward land. If we make it, we'll start over. If we don't, we go down together, one for all forever. Turn.
This is Radio EcoShock. You are listening to Professor Kathleen Dean Moore speaking at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver on March 20th, 2012. The title of the talk is It's Wrong to Wreck the World, Climate Change and the Moral Obligation to the Future. This recording is by Alex Smith.
Why is it wrong to wreck the world? Why must we change our usual ways in order to save the world that is so beautiful and so life-sustaining? What are the moral principles that will guide us in that work? What is this new dream of a good human being? Do we have an obligation to the future? Here is what these people we asked wrote to us, and we categorized their answers into 14 different reasons, the idea being that we're not looking for the one reason to act. We're looking for reasons that will speak to anyone who comes to us with any worldview. Do we have an obligation to the future? Yes, for the sake of the children, and for the sake of the earth itself. Yes, for the full expression of human virtue. Yes, because all flourishing is mutual. Because compassion requires it. Because the world is beautiful. Yes, we have an obligation to honor the rights of future generations of all species and to prevent the violation of human rights. Yes, because our moral integrity requires it. Yes, for the survival of humankind and for the sake of all forms of life on the planet. Yes, to honor our duties of gratitude. Yes, for the stewardship of God's creation. Yes, because justice demands it and because we love the world. And if that doesn't cut it, then there are always issues of national security. I guess. So these are the reasons that we collected and the beautiful essays that came. And as a result of that, I thought that in the time that I have, I would pick out four of these reasons and discuss them in a little bit more detail. The ones that I picked out may not be the ones to speak to you, but they are the ones that particularly called to me. So let's talk first about this one. Do we have an obligation to the future? Yes, for the sake of the children. And you'll recognize the same syllogism. If we have a moral obligation to protect the children, and if environmental degradation is manifestly harmful to them, then we have an obligation to expend extraordinary effort to end those harms and redress the wrongs that we have done. What I want to just take just a moment for you to notice is how extraordinarily dangerous that is, that argument is. That argument is valid. And that means that if the premises are true, the conclusion must be true as well. So the only way a person can escape that conclusion is by denying the truth of one of the premises. This is basic logic. So if a person had an interest in not reducing or eliminating the causes of climate change, if they had, for example, a financial interest in selling all the fossil fuels they could mine, what are they going to do to deny that conclusion? They can't say, heck with the kids. Can they? They can't say, no, I don't believe we have an obligation to children. Of course we have an obligation to children. They're going to have to deny the first premise. They're going to have to deny the facts. So it's no wonder that we have all the climate deniers out there saying, I don't believe the science. I don't think it's coming. If it's coming, I don't think we caused it. And if it's, we caused it, I don't think it's going to hurt anything. It might even make it easier for us to grow asparagus. Okay? You see, the logic that energizes the deniers is right here in front of you. Because you can't deny these moral premises we're talking about. They are commonly held. You have to then go after the science. If you want to deny the conclusion. Okay, that's not what I wanted to talk about. I wanted to talk about that argument that we are harming children even as we believe we're acting to help them. A man at one of these talks came straight up to me. He was huge. I was looking straight at his second button here. And he said, I don't care about climate change. I don't care about ethics. All I care about is my daughter. And I'm going to make as much money as I can so that my daughter has the very best life and as safe as possible as long as she shall live. And I go, it's not going to work. You know, what we're doing to the children as we try to protect them, it's a tragic irony that as we amass material wealth in the name of our children's future, we're taking away the material basis of their future and leaving them a ransacked world to live in. But it doesn't bother me what we're doing to the privileged children nearly as much as it bothers me what we're doing to children who are not privileged. And that's not just ironic. That's awful. That children who are never even going to know the short-term benefits of misusing fossil fuels are the ones who are going to feel it, suffer, as the seas rise, as the fires scorch the cropland, as diseases spread north, as famine returns to lands that had been abundant. And I believe that that kind of damage is a deliberate theft from the children. It is a preventable child abuse. Let me read to you from a 12-year-old girl. Her name is Severin Suzuki, a Canadian, who was speaking at the Rio Convention, and I will read you just a few sentences from what she wrote or read to them. At school, even in kindergarten, you teach us how to behave in the world. You teach us not to fight, to work things out, to respect others, to clean up our mess. Then why do you go out and do the things you tell us not to do? We are your children. You are deciding what kind of world we're growing up in. Parents should be able to comfort their children by saying, everything's going to be all right. It's not the end of the world. But I don't think you can say that to us anymore. My dad always says, you are what you do, not what you say. Well, what you do makes me cry at night. When you edit a book like this, one of the wonderful things is that you can put yourself in it. You can... And I could write anything I wanted for this book, and I decided I wanted to write for this argument. I wanted to write that we have obligations for the sake of the children. And so may I read that? It's also a short little 3.5-minute essay. It's called The Call to Forgiveness at the End of the Day. And what I need to tell you is that the dateline for this essay is May 25th, 2025. So you see what I'm doing? I'm imagining myself 15 years in the future looking back on what has transpired in this intervening time. Okay. All those years, the Swainsons' thrushes were the first to call in the mornings. That's when I would take a cup of tea and walk into the meadow. Swallows sat on the highest perches, whispering as they waited for light to stream onto the pond. For years, there were flocks of goldfinches. After my husband and I poisoned the bull thistles on the far side of the pond, the goldfinches perched in the willows. The garbage truck back down the lane, beeping its backup call, making the frogs sing even in the day. Oh, there was music in the mornings all those years. In the overture to the day, each bird added its call until the morning was an ecstasy of music that faded only when the diesel pumps kicked on to pull water from the stream. Evenings were glorious, too. Just as the sun set, little brown bats began to fly. If a bat swooped close, I'd heard its tiny sonar chirps just at the highest reach of my hearing. Frogs sang and sang, but not like bats or birds, like violin strings just touched by the bow. They sang all evening, thousands of violins and into the night. They sang while crows flew into the oaks and settled their wings, while garter snakes, their stomachs extended with frogs, crawled finally under the fallen bark of the oaks and stretched their lengths against cold ground. I don't know how many frogs there were in the pond then, thousands, tens of thousands. When the eggs hatched, there were tadpoles. I have seen the shallow edge of the pond black with wiggling tadpoles. There were that many, each with a song growing inside it. In the years when the frog choruses began to fade, scientists said it was a fungus. Or maybe bullfrogs were eating the tadpoles. No one knew what to do. When the bats stopped coming, they said that was a fungus too. When the goldfinches came in pairs, not flocks, we told each other the flocks must be feeding in a neighbor's field. No one could guess where the thrushes had gone. The fields were as empty as the perfect emptiness of a bell, the perfectly shaped absence ringing the angelus, the evening song, the call for forgiveness at the end of the day. As it happened, that was the spring when our granddaughter was born. I brought her to the pond so she could feel the comfort I had known there for so many years. Killdeer waddled in the mud by the shore, but even then, not so many as before. By then, the pond had sunk into its warm, weedy places, leaving an expanse of cracked earth. I held my granddaughter in my arms and sang to her then, an old lullaby that made her soften like wax in a flame, molding her little body to my bones. Hush-a-bye, don't you cry. Go to sleep, you little baby. She fell asleep in my arms, unafraid. I will tell you, I was so afraid. Poets warned us, writing of the heartbreaking beauty that will remain when there is no heart to break for it. But what if it's worse than that? What if it's the heartbroken children who remain in a world without beauty? How will they find solace in a world without wild music? How will they thrive without green hills edged with oaks? How will they forgive us for letting frog songs slip away? It isn't enough to love a child and wish her well. It isn't enough to open my heart to a bird-graced morning. Can I claim to love a morning if I don't protect what creates its beauty? Can I claim to love a child if I don't use all the power of my beating heart to preserve a world that nourishes children's joy? Loving is not a kind of la-di-da. Loving is a sacred trust. To love is to affirm the absolute worth of what you love and to pledge your life to its thriving, to protect it fiercely and faithfully for all time. My husband and I were there when the last salmon died in the stream, although we didn't know it then. We came upon her in the creek. Her flank was torn and moldy. The music she made was the riffle of rib bones raking water, then no sound at all as her body settled to the bottom of the pool. But once we had known the music of salmon moving upstream, when the streams were full of salmon, crows called again and again, and seagulls coughed on the gravel bars. Orioles sang, their heads thrown back with singing. Eagles clattered. Water lifted and splashed, swept by strong gray tails, and pebbles rolled downstream. It was a crashing coda, the slam and the buzz and the gull scream. Ring the angelus for the salmon and the swallows. Ring the bells for frogs floating in bent reeds. Ring the bells for all of us who did not save the song. Mother of God, ring the bells for every sacred emptiness. Let them echo in the silence at the end of the day. Forgiveness is too much to ask. I would pray for only this, that our granddaughter would hear again the little lick of music, that grace note toward the end of a meadowlark's song. Meadowlarks. There were meadowlarks. They sang like angels in the morning. We all know that our well-being is threatened by climate change. Let's move on to this notion that we have to act on climate change in order to honor basic human rights. You know, if people have rights to life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness, then the carbon-spewing nations of the world are embarked on the greatest violation of human rights the world has ever seen. Uprooted from their homes, exposed to new disease vectors, on the wrong end of disruptive food chains. It's a systematic denial of human rights. By whom? By the rich nations of the world and the fuel smoke-spewing nations of the world. To what end? For the continuation of wasteful and pointless consumption of material goods. And it's not just a violation of rights. It's an injustice because the people who are suffering and who are going to suffer the most are not the ones who are enjoying the benefits of the profligate use of the fuels, at least in the short term. They're the ones who are suffering until it engulfs us all, and that's not fair. And the thing that bothers me, that really catches me in the craw, is that the ones who are going to suffer the most are the ones who cannot speak in their own defense. They need us. They are calling to us to speak in their defense. Who are these silent? They're future people who have no way of calling to us. They're the plants and the animals and the ecosystems who are calling to us. They are marginalized people everywhere, economically marginalized, geographically marginalized, educationally marginalized people, and they are our children.
I'm Alex Smith. I recorded this speech in Vancouver for Radio EcoShock. The title is, It's Wrong to Wreck the World, Climate Change and the Moral Obligation to the Future. Here is Kathleen Dean Moore.
These are the ones who are going to have to make a life in whatever's left of the world after we're done plundering it. And let me just quickly reference Shilawat Cloutier, the former head of the Inuit Supreme Polar Council, who wrote, what we are doing here, their petition to the International Human Rights Council, what we're doing here is we are defending our right to culture, our right to lands traditionally used and occupied, our right to health, our right to physical security, our right to our own means of subsistence, and our rights to residence and movement. And as our culture is based on the cold, the ice and snow, we are, in essence, defending our right to be cold. So this is the fourth of the four that I wanted to talk about, because our integrity demands us. And I want to talk about integrity, but first I want to talk about hope. And I want to check in with you here. If you were asked to rate yourself on this scale, where zero means we have no chance of preventing climate change and the catastrophes that will follow it, or 10, you know, I sleep well at night, we can do this, we're doing it. Where are you, if you would think a minute of that number? It's really a problem, this thing about hope, because it's true. Yeah, it's true that our options are limited and that our cities are disgracefully designed when it comes to using fuel, and that destructive ways of living are very skillfully linked to tangles of profit and power in the world, and we don't have very much time. Even the most conscientious person, the most hopeful person, is going to have trouble making significant change. And Gus Speth, the former dean at the Yale Law School, says, all we have to do to destroy the planet's climate and ecosystem and leave a ruined world to our children and grandchildren is to keep doing exactly what we are doing today. This is a problem. And here's the problem. Well, there's lots of problems. The one I want to talk about in particular is this, that we are utilitarians. That is to say, we judge the rightness or wrongness of our acts by their consequences. When we think we cannot have good consequences to our acts, we completely abandon morality. So we've created a situation where, on the one hand, you could be hopeful. But if you lose hope, you fall into this abyss, which is despair, which is the abdication of moral responsibility. What I want to point out to you is that also is a fallacy. That's a fallacy of false dichotomy, because between hope and despair is this very broad landscape, and we call that integrity. Integrity, acting in the way you believe in, doing what's right because you believe it's right, finding a way that your actions and your values integrate. And that, I think, is what we're called to do in these very, very dangerous times. I'd like to talk about that then in terms of what does it mean in particular? It's always the question that always arises, particularly with my students. What does that mean in particular? How should we go forward? Let me briefly mention just two things that seem to me to be important to say. And one is that we can choose to refuse to allow ourselves to be used as instruments of destruction. This is part of what integrity means. It means to say, I am not going to allow you to use me to wreck the world. I refuse to do what I don't believe in. I refuse to drive a car I don't believe in. I refuse to eat food I don't believe in. I refuse to do a job I don't believe in. I will not make thoughtless decisions about what I invest in. I will not make thoughtless decisions about what I buy or what I praise. I won't make thoughtless decisions about what I value. I will not volunteer to be a foot soldier in the corporate destruction of the world that I love. And I will not allow myself to be used as a consumer rather than to treat myself as a moral agent. I am not a consumer. I do consume, but primarily I'm a moral agent and I make my own decisions. I will not enrich the people who disdain me. That, I think, is what we got to do first. I'm not kidding about people who disdain us. There's this big mobile oil ad, maybe you've seen it, shows the cloud-splashed Earth, and underneath it says, Mother Earth is a tough old gal. You've seen that one? I wrote back to them, and I said, you know, if the Earth were your mother, she would grab you in one rocky hand and hold you underwater till you no longer bubbled. Imagine. So we can draw down on atmospheric carbon dioxide to livable levels. But we can't do it until we can draw down the power of those who are enriched by destroying the conditions of human and ecological thriving. And we're not going to draw down that power or even regulate it until we find a way to end the futures market in politicians. I don't know what's happening in Canada, but I can tell you that in the United States, millions and millions and millions of dollars are being invested in campaigns to elect people who will allow corporations to destroy the world. So this is a call to conscientious objection. People said to the Vietnam War, hell no, I don't believe in that war, I'm not going to fight it. Can we say the same to an unjust and a far more disastrous economic system? That's step one. That's step one, I think, of the negative part of what we are called to do. Step two is the positive part, of course, and that is that we can align our values. We can align our values with our actions. Refusal's not enough, and everybody knows it. We're looking for something more, something that's not so grief-stricken. Now, I advise people not to leave their grief behind. Grief is a very powerful thing. And I love what your beautiful songwriter, Leonard Cohen, said when he said, yes, we live with broken hearts in a broken world, but that's no alibi for anything. We must sing a broken-hearted hallelujah. So let us turn to the joy. Because the other part of integrity is to make our lives into works of art that express our deepest values. And as we live with integrity, we can imagine and we can bring into being new ways of living on the land that are bright with art and imagination, and that are nested into families and communities, where we become part of communities of caring that are grateful and joyous. Let me just close then by reading one last short essay. And this is my response to my students. You recognize Mount St. Helens? Okay, Washington State volcano that blew up in 1980. This is basically built about that. It's called Refugia of the Imagination. This also is 3 minutes. Those scientists were so wrong back in 1980. When they climbed from the helicopters holding handkerchiefs over their faces to filter ash from the Mount St. Helens eruption, they did not think they would live long enough to see life restored to the blast zone. Every tree was burned and ruined, every ridgeline buried in ash, every stream clogged with broken limbs and landslides. If anything would grow here again, they thought, its seed would have to drift in from the edges of the devastation long, dry miles across a plain of cinders and ash. The scientists could imagine that, spiders drifting on silk threads over the rubble plain, a single seed spinning into the shade of a pumice stone. It was harder to imagine the time required for flourishing to return to the mountain, all the dusty centuries. But here they are. On the mountain, only 30 years later, these same scientists are on their knees, running their hands over beds of moss below lupin in lavish purple bloom. Tracks of mice and fox etch a muddy stream bank. What the scientists know now, but didn't understand then, is that when the mountain blasted ash and rock across the landscape, the devastation never touched some small places hidden in the lee of rocks and trees. Here, a bed of moss and deer fern under a rotting log. There, under a boulder, a patch of pearly everlasting in the tunnel to a vole's nest. Between stones in a buried stream, a slick of algae and clustered dragonfly eggs. Refugia, they call them, small places of safety where life endures. From the microenvironments of the refugia, mice and toads emerge blinking onto the blasted plain. From 1,000, 10,000, maybe countless small places of enduring life, meadows return to the mountain. I have seen this happen. I have wandered the edge of vernal pools with ecologists brought to unscientific tears by the song of meadowlarks in these places. So I'm careful when I talk to my students. They have been taught, as they deserve to be, that the fossil-fueled industrial growth economy has brought the world to the edge of catastrophe. They understand the decimation of plant and animal species, the growing deserts and spreading famine. If it's true that we can't destroy our habitats without destroying our lives, as Rachel Carson said, and if it's true that we are in the process of laying waste to the planet, then our ways of living will come to an end, some way or another, sooner or later, gradually or catastrophically, and some new way of life will begin, What are we supposed to do? Students ask me. How can we do any good when the job is nothing less than saving the world? These are terrifying questions for an old professor, and it has taken me some months to think of what to say. I have decided to tell them about the volcano. I tell them about the rotted stump that shelled spider eggs, about a cupped rock that saved a fern. If destructive forces are building under our lives, then our work in this time and place, I tell them, is not to stop the mountain from cracking apart. No one can do this. But now to create small refugia of the imagination to reseed the ashy plain. Refugia, places where new ideas are sheltered and encouraged to grow. Even now we can create small pockets of flourishing, and we can make ourselves into overhanging rock ledges to protect their life, so that the full measure of possibility can spread and reseed the world. It doesn't matter what it is, I tell my students, or how small. If it's generous to life, imagine it into existence. Create a bicycle cooperative, a seed-sharing community, a wildlife sanctuary on the hill below the church. Plant native grass. Imagine water pumps. Dig a community garden in the parking lot. Study corn. Learn to cook with the full power of the sun at noon. We don't have to start from scratch. We can restore pockets of flourishing lifeways that have been damaged over time. And maybe most effective of all, we can protect refugia that already exist. There are small pockets tucked into every corner. Boycott what you don't believe in. Refuse to participate in what is wrong. There is hope in this, an attention that notices and celebrates thriving where it occurs, a conscience that refuses to destroy it. This is integrity, I tell my students, which is whole, which is healthy, which is holy. This is consistency of belief and action, and that is the answer to powerlessness, to do what you think is right, knowing that your actions will be the wellspring of the new world. From these sheltered pockets of moral imagining, and from the protected pockets of flourishing, new ways of living will spread across the land, across the salt plains and beetle-killed forests. Here is how we will start anew, not from the edges over centuries of invasion, rather from small pockets of good work, shaped by an understanding that all life is interdependent and driven by the one gift human have that belongs to no other, practical imagination, the ability to imagine that things can be different from what they are now. Your calling, the philosopher Frederick Buechner said, is at the intersection of your great joy and the world's deepest need. Your calling is at the intersection of your great joy and the world's deepest need. Go to that place, I tell my students, do that work. Thank you very much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. You know, I record a lot of speeches and listen to many more. This talk by Dr. Kathleen Dean Moore of Oregon State University is in my top three for the best speech of 2012. The title was, It's Wrong to Wreck the World: Climate Change and the Moral Obligation to the Future. The presentation was organized by Simon Fraser University in their Continuing Studies in Science and Environment program. This recording is by Alex Smith. After the radio broadcast, you can download a free MP3 of this program from our website at ecoshock.org. Find out more about Kathleen Dean Moore at her blog at riverwalking.com. Her latest book, a collection of 1,500 short essays about our obligation to the future, is called Moral Ground, Ethical Action for a Planet in Peril. Thank you so much for listening.